water out before he began to nudge the white meat off the shell with a knife. Her hand shook as she poured rice into the boiling water, and as she watched the narrow basmati grains begin to swell, she wondered if they were failing at this, their reconciliatory meal. She checked the chicken on the stove. The spices wafted up when she opened the pot, ginger and curry and bay leaves, and she told him, unnecessarily, that it looked good.
"I didn't overspice it like you do," he said.
She felt a momentary anger and wanted to say that it was unfair of him to hold out forgiveness like this, but instead she asked if he thought she should add some water. He kept grating the coconuts and said nothing. She watched the coconut crumble into white dust. It saddened her to think that it would never be a whole coconut again, and she reached out and held Blaine from the back, wrapped her arms around his chest, felt the warmth through his sweatshirt. But he eased away and said he had to finish before the rice got too soft. She walked across the living room to look out of the window at the clock tower high and regal, imposing itself on the other buildings of the Yale campus below, and saw the first snow flurries swirling through the late evening air, as though flung from above. And she remembered her first winter with him, when everything had seemed burnished and unendingly new. Understanding America for the non-American black. A few explanations of what things really mean. 1. Of all their tribalisms, Americans are most uncomfortable with race. If you are having a conversation with an American and you want to discuss something racial that you find interesting, and the American says, "Oh, it's simplistic to say it's race. Racism is so complex," it means they just want you to shut up already. Because, of course, racism is complex. Many abolitionists wanted to free the slaves, but didn't want black people living nearby. Lots of folk today don't mind a black nanny or black limo driver, but they sure as hell mind a black boss. What is simplistic is saying, "It's so complex. But shut up anyway, especially if you need a job/favor from the American in question." 2. Diversity means different things to different folks. If a white person is saying a neighborhood is diverse, they mean 9% black people. The minute it gets to 10% black people, the white folks move out. If a black person says diverse neighborhood, they are thinking 40% black. 3. Sometimes they say culture when they mean race. They say a film is mainstream when they mean white folks like it or made it. When they say urban, it means black and poor and possibly dangerous and potentially exciting. Racially charged means we are uncomfortable saying racist. Chapter 40. They did not fight again until the relationship ended, but in the time of Blaine's stoniness, when Ifemelu burrowed into herself and ate whole chocolate bars, her feelings for him changed. She still admired him, his moral fibre, his life of clean lines, but now it was admiration for a person separate from her, a person far away. And her body had changed. In bed, she did not turn to him full of a raw wanting as she used to do, and when he reached for her, her first instinct was to roll away. They kissed often, but always with her lips firmly pursed. She did not want his tongue in her mouth. Their union was leached of passion, but there was a new passion, outside of themselves, that united them in an intimacy they had never had before, an unfixed, unspoken, intuitive intimacy. Barack Obama. They agreed without any prodding, without the shadows of obligation or compromise, on Barack Obama. At first, even though she wished America would elect a black man as president, she thought it impossible, and she could not imagine Obama as president of the United States. He seemed too slight, too skinny, a man who would be blown away by the wind. Hillary Clinton was sturdier. Ifemelu liked to watch Clinton on television, in her square trouser suits, her face a mask of resolve, her prettiness disguised, because that was the only way to convince the world that she was able. Ifemelu liked her. She wished her victory, willed good fortune her way. Until the morning she picked up Barack Obama's book, Dreams from My Father, which Blaine had just finished and left lying on the bookshelf, some of its pages folded in. She examined the photographs on the cover. The young Kenyan woman, staring befuddled at the camera, arms enclosing her son, and the young American man, jaunty of manner, holding his daughter to his chest.
Ephemera would later remember the moment she decided to read the book. Just to see. She might not have read it if Blaine had recommended it, because she more and more avoided the books he liked. But he had not recommended it. He had merely left it on the shelf, next to a pile of other books he had finished, but meant to go back to. She read Dreams from My Father in a day and a half, sitting up on the couch, Nina Simone playing on Blaine's iPod speaker. She was absorbed and moved by the man she met in those pages, an inquiring and intelligent man, a kind man, a man so utterly, helplessly, winningly humane. He reminded her of Obinze's expression for people he liked, Obiocha, a clean heart. She believed Barack Obama. When Blaine came home, she sat at the dining table, watching him chop fresh basil in the kitchen, and said, "If only the man who wrote this book could be the President of America." Blaine's knife stopped moving. He looked up, eyes lit, as though he dared not hope she would believe the same thing he believed, and she felt between them the first pulse of a shared passion. They clutched each other in front of the television when Barack Obama won the Iowa caucuses. The first battle, and he had won. Their hope was radiating, exploding into possibility. Obama could actually win this thing. And then, as though choreographed, they began to worry. They worried that something would derail him, crash his fast-moving train. Every morning, Ifemelu woke up and checked to make sure that Obama was still alive, that no scandal had emerged, no story dug up from his past. She would turn on her computer, her breath still, her heart frantic in her chest, and then, reassured that he was alive, she would read the latest news about him, quickly and greedily, seeking information and reassurance, multiple windows minimized at the bottom of the screen. Sometimes in chat rooms, she wilted as she read the posts about Obama, and she would get up and move away from her computer, as though the laptop itself were the enemy, and stand by the window to hide her tears even from herself. "How can a monkey be president? Somebody do us a favor and put a bullet in this guy. Send him back to the African jungle. A black man will never be in the White House, dude. It's called a White House for a reason." She tried to imagine the people who wrote those posts, under monikers like Suburban Mom 231 and Norman Rockwell Rocks. Sitting at their desks, a cup of coffee beside them, and their children about to come home on the school bus in a glow of innocence. The chat rooms made her blog feel inconsequential, a comedy of manners, a mild satire about a world that was anything but mild. She did not blog about the vileness that seemed to have multiplied each morning she logged on, more chat rooms springing up, more vitriol flourishing, because to do so would be to spread the words of people who abhorred not the man that Barack Obama was, but the idea of him as president. She blogged instead about his policy positions in a recurring post titled, "This is why Obama will do it better," often adding links to his website. And she blogged too about Michelle Obama. She gloried in the offbeat dryness of Michelle Obama's humor, the confidence in her long-limbed carriage. And then she mourned when Michelle Obama was clamped, flattened, made to sound tepidly wholesome in interviews. Still, there was in Michelle Obama's overly arched eyebrows and in her belt worn higher on her waist than tradition would care for, a glint of her old self. It was this that drew Ifemelu, the absence of apology, the promise of honesty. "If she married Obama, then he can't be that bad," she joked often with Blaine, and Blaine would say, "True that, true that." She got an email from a Princeton.edu address, and before she read it, her hands shook from excitement. The first word she saw was pleased. She had received the research fellowship. The pay was good, the requirements easy. She was expected to live in Princeton and use the library and give a public talk at the end of the year. It seemed too good to be true. An entry into a hallowed American kingdom. She and Blaine took the train to Princeton to look for an apartment, and she was struck by the town itself, the greenness, the peace and grace of it. "I got into Princeton for undergrad," Blaine told her. "It was almost bucolic then. I visited and thought it was beautiful, but I just couldn't see myself actually going there." Ifemelu knew what he meant, even now that it had changed and become, in Blaine's words, when they walked past the rows of shiny stores, "aggressively consumer capitalist." She felt admiration and disorientation. She liked her apartment off Nassau Street, the bedroom window looking out to a grove of trees, and she walked the empty room thinking of a new beginning for herself, without Blaine, and yet unsure if this was truly the new beginning she wanted.
"I'm not moving Kia until after the election," she said. Blaine nodded before she finished speaking. Of course she would not move until they had seen Barack Obama through to his victory. He became a volunteer for the Obama campaign, and she absorbed all of his stories about the doors he knocked on and the people behind them. One day he came home and told her about an old black woman, face shriveled like a prune, who stood holding onto her door as though she might fall otherwise, and told him,
"I didn't think this would happen even in my grandbaby's lifetime."
Ifemelu blogged about this story, describing the silver streaks in the woman's grey hair, the fingers quivering from Parkinson's, as though she herself had been there with Blaine. All of his friends were Obama supporters, except for Michael, who always wore a Hillary Clinton pin on his breast, and at their gatherings, Ifemelu no longer felt excluded. Even that nebulous unease when she was around Paula, part churlishness and part insecurity, had melted away. They gathered at bars and apartments, discussing details of the campaign, mocking the silliness of the news stories.
Will Hispanics vote for a black man? Can he bowl? Is he patriotic?
Isn't it funny how they say blacks want Obama and women want Hillary? But what about black women? Paula said.
When they say women, they automatically mean white women, of course, Grace said.
What I don't understand is how anybody can say that Obama is benefiting because he's a black man, Paula said.
It's complicated, but he is, and also to the extent that Clinton is benefiting because she's a white woman, Nathan said, leaning forward and blinking even more quickly. If Clinton were a black woman, her star would not shine so brightly. If Obama were a white man, his star might or might not shine so brightly because some white men have become president who had no business being president. But that doesn't change the fact that Obama doesn't have a lot of experience, and people are really excited by the idea of a black candidate who has a real chance.
Although if he wins, he will no longer be black, just as Oprah is no longer black. She is Oprah, Grace said. So she can go where black people are loathed and be fine. He'll no longer be black. He'll just be Obama.
To the extent that Obama is benefiting, and that idea of benefiting is very problematic, by the way, but to the extent that he is, it's not because he's black. It's because he's a different kind of black,
Blaine said.
If Obama didn't have a white mother and wasn't raised by white grandparents, and didn't have Kenya and Indonesia and Hawaii and all of the stories that make him somehow a bit like everyone, if he was just a plain black guy from Georgia, it would be different. America will have made real progress when an ordinary black guy from Georgia becomes president, a black guy who got a C average in college.
I agree, Nathan said. And it struck Ifemelu anew how much everyone agreed. Their friends, like her and Blaine, were believers. True believers. On the day Barack Obama became the nominee of the Democratic Party, Ifemelu and Blaine made love for the first time in weeks, and Obama was there with them, like an unspoken prayer, a third emotional presence. She and Blaine drove hours to hear him speak, holding hands in a thick crowd, raising placards, change written on them in a bold white print. A black man nearby had hoisted his son onto his shoulders, and the son was laughing, his mouth full of milky teeth, one missing from the upper row. The father was looking up, and Ifemelu knew that he was stunned by his own faith, stunned to find himself believing in things he did not think he ever would. When the crowd exploded in applause, clapping and whistling, the man could not clap because he was holding his son's legs, and so he just smiled and smiled, his face suddenly young with joyfulness. Ifemelu watched him, and the other people around them, all glowing with a strange phosphorescence, all treading a single line of unbroken emotion. They believed. They truly believed. It often came to her as a sweet shock, the knowledge that there were so many people in the world who felt exactly as she and Blaine did about Barack Obama. On some days their faith soared. On other days they despaired.
"This is not good," Blaine muttered, as they went back and forth between different television channels, each showing the footage of Barack Obama's pastor giving a sermon, and his words, "God damn America,"
seared their way into Ifemelu's dreams.
She first read on the internet the breaking news that Barack Obama would give a speech on race, in response to the footage of his pastor, and she sent a text to Blaine, who was teaching a class. His reply was simple, "Yes." Later, watching the speech, seated between Blaine and Grace on their living room couch, Ifemelu wondered what Obama was truly thinking and what he would feel as he lay in bed that night when all was quiet and empty. She imagined him, the boy who knew his grandmother was afraid of black men, now a man telling that story to the world to redeem himself. She felt a small sadness at this thought. As Obama spoke, compassionate and cadenced, American flags fluttering behind him, Blaine shifted, sighed, leaned back on the couch. Finally, Blaine said,
"It's immoral to equate black grievance and white fear like this. It's just immoral." The speech was not done to open up a conversation about race, but actually to close it. He can win only if he avoids race. We all know that, Grace said. But the important thing is to get him into office first. The guy's got to do what he's got to do. At least now this pastor business is closed.
Ifemelu, too, felt pragmatic about the speech, but Blaine took it personally. His faith cracked. And for a few days, he lacked his bounce, coming back from his morning run without his usual sweaty high, walking around heavy-footed. It was Shan who unknowingly pulled him out of his slump.
"I have to go to the city for a few days to be with Shan," he told Ifemelu. "Ovidio just called me. She's not functioning."
"She's not functioning?"
"A nervous breakdown. I dislike that expression. It has a very old wives' tale vibe to it. But that's what Ovidio called it. She's been in bed for days. She's not eating. She won't stop crying."
Ifemelu felt a flash of irritation. Even this, it seemed to her, was yet another way for Shan to demand attention.
"She's had a really hard time," Blaine said. "The book not getting any attention and all."
"I know," Ifemelu said, and yet she could feel no real sympathy, which frightened her. Perhaps it was because she held Shan responsible at some level for the fight with Blaine, for not wielding her power over Blaine to let him know he was overreacting. "She'll be fine," Ifemelu said. "She's a strong person." Blaine looked at her with surprise.
"Shan is one of the most fragile people in the world. She's not strong, she's never been, but she's special."
The last time Ifemelu had seen Shan, about a month ago, Shan had said,
"I just knew you and Blaine would get back together."
Hers was the tone of a person talking about a beloved sibling who had returned to psychedelic drugs.
"Isn't Obama exciting?"
Ifemelu had asked, hoping that this would at least be something she and Shan could talk about without an underlying prick of pins.
"Oh, I'm not following this election," Shan had said dismissively. "Have you read his book?"
Ifemelu asked.
"No," Shan shrugged. "It would be good if somebody read my book."
Ifemelu swallowed her words.
"It's not about you. For once, it's not about you. You should read Dreams from My Father. The other books are campaign documents," Ifemelu said. "He's the real deal."
But Shan was not interested. She was talking about a panel she had done the week before at a writer's festival.
"So they asked me who my favorite writers are? Of course, I know they expected mostly black writers, and no way am I going to tell them that Robert Hayden is the love of my life, which he is. So I didn't mention anybody black or remotely of color or politically inclined or alive. And so I name, with insouciant aplomb, Turgenev and Trollope and Goethe. But so as not to be too indebted to dead white males, because that would be a little too unoriginal, I added Selma Lagerlöf. And suddenly they don't know what to ask me, because I'd thrown the script out the window."
"That's so funny," Blaine said. On the eve of election day, Ifemelu lay sleepless in bed.
"You awake?"
Blaine asked her.
"Yes."
They held each other in the dark, saying nothing, their breathing regular, until finally they drifted into a state of half-sleep and half-wakefulness. In the morning, they went to the high school. Blaine wanted to be one of the first to vote. Ifemelu watched the people already there in line waiting for the door to open, and she willed them all to vote for Obama. It felt to her like a bereavement that she could not vote. Her application for citizenship had been approved, but the oath-taking was still weeks away. She spent a restless morning, checking all the news sites, and when Blaine came back from class, he asked her to turn off the computer and television so they could take a break, breathe deeply, eat the risotto he had made. They had barely finished eating before Ifemelu turned her computer back on, just to make sure Barack Obama was alive and well. Blaine made virgin cocktails for their friends. Araminta arrived first, straight from the train station, holding two phones, checking for updates on both. Then Grace arrived in her swishy silks, a golden scarf at her neck, saying, "Oh God, I can't breathe for nervousness." Michael came with a bottle of Prosecco.
"I wish my mama was alive to see this day, no matter what happens," he said.
Paula and P and Nathan arrived together, and soon they were all seated on the couch in the dining chairs, eyes on the television, sipping tea in Blaine's virgin cocktails and repeating the same things they had said before. "If he wins Indiana and Pennsylvania, then that's it.
It's looking good in Florida."
"The news from Iowa is conflicting."
"There's a huge black voter turnout in Virginia, so it's looking good," Ifemelu said.
"Virginia is unlikely," Nathan said.
"He doesn't need Virginia,"
Grace said, and then she screamed, "Oh my God, Pennsylvania!" A graphic had flashed on the television screen, a photo of Barack Obama. He had won the states of Pennsylvania and Ohio.
"I don't see how McCain can do this now,"
Nathan said. Paula was sitting next to Ifemelu a short while later when the flash of graphics appeared on the screen. Barack Obama had won the state of Virginia.
"Oh my God,"
Paula said, her hand trembling at her mouth. Blaine was sitting straight and still, staring at the television. And then came the deep voice of Keith Olbermann, whom Ifemelu had watched so obsessively on MSNBC in the past months, the voice of a searing, sparkling liberal rage. Now that voice was saying,
"Barack Obama is projected to be the next president of the United States of America."
Blaine was crying, holding Araminta, who was crying, and then holding Ifemelu, squeezing her too tight. And P was hugging Michael, and Grace was hugging Nathan, and Paula was hugging Araminta, and Ifemelu was hugging Grace, and the living room became an altar of disbelieving joy. Her phone beeped with a text from DK.
"I can't believe it. My president is black, like me."
She read the text a few times, her eyes filling with tears. On television, Barack Obama and Michelle Obama and their two young daughters were walking onto a stage. They were carried by the wind, bathed in incandescent light, victorious and smiling.
"Young and old, rich and poor, Democrat and Republican, black, white, Hispanic, Asian, Native American, gay, straight, disabled, and not disabled, Americans have sent a message to the world that we have never been just a collection of red states and blue states. We have been, and always will be, the United States of America."
Barack Obama's voice rose and fell, his face solemn, and around him the large and resplendent crowd of the hopeful. Ifemelu watched, mesmerized, and there was, at that moment, nothing that was more beautiful to her than America. Understanding America for the non-American black. Thoughts on the special white friend. One great gift for the zipped-up Negro is the white friend who gets it. Sadly, this is not as common as one would wish, but some are lucky to have that white friend who you don't need to explain shit to. By all means, put this friend to work. Such friends not only get it, but also have great bullshit detectors, and so they totally understand that they can say stuff that you can't. So, there is, in much of America, a stealthy little notion lying in the hearts of many, that white people earned their places at jobs and school, while black people got in because they were black. But in fact, since the beginning of America, white people have been getting jobs because they are white. Many whites, with the same qualifications but Negro skin, would not have the jobs they have. But don't ever say this publicly. Let your white friend say it. If you make the mistake of saying this, you will be accused of a curiosity called playing the race card. Nobody knows quite what this means. When my father was in school in my NAB country, many American blacks could not vote or go to good schools. the reason? Their skin color. Skin color alone was the problem. Today, many Americans say that skin color cannot be part of the solution. Otherwise, it is referred to as a curiosity called reverse racism. Have your white friend point out how the American black deal is kind of like you've been unjustly imprisoned for many years, then all of a sudden you're set free, but you get no bus fare. And, by the way, you and the guy who imprisoned you are now automatically equal. If the slavery was so long ago thing comes up, have your white friend say that lots of white folks are still inheriting money that their families made 100 years ago. So if that legacy lives, why not the legacy of slavery? And have your white friend say how funny it is that American pollsters ask white and black people if racism is over. White people in general say it is over, and black people in general say it is not. Funny indeed. More suggestions for what you should have your white friend say? Please post away. And here's to all the white friends who get it. Chapter 41. Aisha pulled out her phone from her pocket and then slipped it back with a frustrated sigh.
I don't know why Chijioke not called to come, she said.
Ifemelu said nothing. She and Aisha were alone in the salon. Halima had just left. Ifemelu was tired and her back throbbed, and the salon had begun to nauseate her with its stuffy air and rotting ceiling. Why couldn't these African women keep their salon clean and ventilated? Her hair was almost finished. Only a small section like a rabbit's tail was left at the front of her head. She was eager to leave.
How you get your papers?
Aisha asked. What?
How you get your papers?
Ifemelu was startled into silence. A sacrilege, that question. Immigrants did not ask other immigrants how they got their papers, did not burrow into those layered private places. It was sufficient simply to admire that the papers had been got, a legal status acquired.
Me? I try an American when I come, to marry. But he bring many problems, no job, and every day he say give me money, money, money.
Aisha said, shaking her head.
How you get your own?
Suddenly, Ifemelu's irritation dissolved, and in its place, a gossamered sense of kinship grew, because Aisha would not have asked if she were not an African. And in this new bond, she saw yet another augury of her return home.
I got mine from work, she said. The company I worked for sponsored my green card.
Oh, Aisha said, as though she had just realized that Ifemelu belonged to a group of people whose green card simply fell from the sky. People like her could not, of course, get theirs from an employer.
Chijioke get his papers with lottery,
Aisha said. She slowly, almost lovingly, combed the section of hair she was about to twist. What happened to your hand? Ifemelu asked. Aisha shrugged.
I don't know. It just come, and after it go.
My aunt is a doctor. I'll take a picture of your arm and ask her what she thinks, Ifemelu said.
Thank you.
Aisha finished a twist in silence.
My father die. I don't go,
she said. What?
Last year, my father die, and I don't go, because of papers. But maybe, if Chijioke marry me, when my mother die, I can go. She is sick now, but I send her money.
For a moment, Ifemelu did not know what to say. Aisha's wan tone, her expressionless face, magnified her tragedy.
Sorry, Aisha, she said.
I don't know why Chijioke not come. So you talk to him.
Don't worry, Aisha. It will be okay.
Then, just as suddenly as she had spoken, Aisha began to cry. Her eyes melted, her mouth caved, and a terrifying thing happened to her face. It collapsed into despair. She kept twisting Ifemelu's hair, her hand movements unchanged, while her face, as though it did not belong to her body, continued to crumple, tears running from her eyes, her chest heaving.
Where does Chijioke work? Ifemelu asked,
I will go there and talk to him. Aisha stared at her, the tears still sliding down her cheeks. I will go and talk to Chijioke tomorrow, Ifemelu repeated. Just tell me where he works and what time he goes on break. What was she doing? She should get up and leave and not be dragged further into Aisha's morass. But she could not get up and leave. She was about to go home to Nigeria, and she would see her parents, and she would come back to America if she wished. And here was Aisha, hoping but not really believing that she would ever see her mother again. She would talk to this Chijioke. It was the least she could do. She brushed the hair from her clothes and gave Aisha a thin roll of dollars. Aisha spread it out on her palm, counting briskly, and Ifemelu wondered how much would go to Mariama and how much to Aisha. She waited for Aisha to put the money into her pocket before she gave her the tip. Aisha took the single $20 bill, her eyes now dried of tears, her face back to its expressionlessness.
Thank you.
The room was dense with awkwardness, and Ifemelu, as though to dilute it, once again examined her hair in the mirror, patting it lightly as she turned this way and that. I will go and see Chijioke tomorrow, and I will call you, Ifemelu said. She brushed at her clothes for any stray bits of hair, and looked around to make sure she had taken everything.
Thank you.
Aisha moved towards Ifemelu, as though to embrace her, then stopped, hesitant. Ifemelu gripped her shoulder gently, before turning to the door. On the train, she wondered just how she would persuade a man who didn't seem keen to marry to do so. Her head was aching, and the hair at her temples, even though Aisha had not twisted too tightly, still caused a tugging discomfort, a disturbance of her neck and nerves. She longed to get home and have a long, cold shower, put her hair up in a satin bonnet, and lie down on her couch with her laptop. The train had just stopped at Princeton Station when her phone rang. She stopped on the platform to fumble in her bag for it, and at first, because Auntie Uju was incoherent, talking and sobbing at the same time, Ifemelu thought she had said that Dike was dead. But what Auntie Uju was saying was,
Onwuchakwa, Dike Onwuchakwa.
Dike had nearly died.
He took an overdose of pills and went down to the basement and lay down on the couch there,
Auntie Uju said, her voice cracked with her own disbelief.
I never go to the basement when I come back. I only do my yoga in the morning. It was God that told me to go down today to defrost the meat in the freezer. It was God. I saw him lying there, looking so sweaty, sweat all over his body, and immediately I panicked. I said, these people have been giving my son drugs.
Ifemelu was shaking. A train whooshed past, and she pressed her finger into her other ear to hear Auntie Uju's voice better. Auntie Uju was saying,
signs of liver toxicity.
And Ifemelu felt choked by those words, liver toxicity, by her confusion, by the sudden darkling of the air.
Ifem,
Auntie Uju said,
are you there?
Yes. The word had travelled up a long tunnel. What happened? What exactly happened, Auntie? What are you saying?
He swallowed a whole bottle of Tylenol. He's in the ICU now, and he will be fine. God was not ready for him to die. That is all,
Auntie Uju said. The sound of her nose blowing was loud over the phone.
Do you know? He also took anti-nausea so that the medicine would stay in his stomach. God was not ready for him to die.
I am coming tomorrow, Ifemelu said. She stood on the platform for a long time and wondered what she had been doing while Dike was swallowing a bottle of pills. Part 5 Chapter 42 Obinze checked his BlackBerry often, too often, even when he got up at night to go to the toilet, and although he mocked himself, he could not stop checking. 4 days, 4 whole days passed before she replied. This dampened him. She was never coy, and she would have ordinarily replied much sooner. She might be busy, he told himself, although he knew very well how convenient and unconvincing a reason busy was. Or she might have changed and become the kind of woman who waited convincing a reason busy was. Or she might have changed and become the kind of woman who waited 4 whole days so that she would not seem too eager, a thought that dampened him even more. Her email was warm,
but too short, telling him she was excited and nervous about leaving her life and moving back home, but there were no specifics. When was she moving back exactly? And what was it that was so difficult to leave behind? He googled the Black American again, hoping perhaps to find a blog post about a breakup, but the blog only had links to academic papers. One of them was on early hip-hop music as political activism. How American to study hip-hop as a viable subject. And he read it hoping it would be silly, but it was interesting enough for him to read all the way to the end, and this soured his stomach. The Black American had become, absurdly, a rival. He tried Facebook. Corsi was active on Facebook. She put up photos and kept in touch with people, but he had deleted his account a while ago. He had at first been excited by Facebook, ghosts of old friends suddenly morphing to life with wives and husbands and children, and photos trailed by comments. But he began to be appalled by the air of unreality, the careful manipulation of images to create a parallel life, pictures that people had taken with Facebook in mind, placing in the background the things of which they were proud. Now he reactivated his file to search for Ifemelu, but she did not have a Facebook profile. Perhaps she was as unenchanted with Facebook as he was. This pleased him vaguely, another example of how similar they were. Her Black American was on Facebook, but his profile was visible only to his friends, and for a crazed moment Obinze considered sending him a friend request, just to see if he had posted pictures of Ifemelu. He wanted to wait a few days before replying to her, but he found himself that night in his study writing her a long email about the death of his mother. I never thought that she would die until she died. Does this make sense? He had discovered that grief did not dim with time. It was instead a volatile state of being. Sometimes the pain was as abrupt as it was on the day her house help called him sobbing to say she was lying, unbreathing on her bed. Other times he forgot that she had died and would make cursory plans about flying to the east to see her. She had looked askance at his new wealth, as though she did not understand a world in which a person could make so much so easily. After he bought her a new car as a surprise, she told him her old car was perfectly fine, the Peugeot 505 she had been driving since he was in secondary school. He had the car delivered to her house, a small Honda that she would not think too ostentatious, but each time he visited, he saw it, parked in the garage, coated in a translucent haze of dust. He remembered very clearly his last conversation with her over the phone, 3 days before she died. Her growing despondence with her job and with life on the campus.
Nobody publishes in international journals, she had said. Nobody goes to conferences. It's like a shallow, muddy pond that we are all wallowing in.
He wrote this in his email to Ifemelu, how his mother's sadness with her job had also made him sad. He was careful not to be too heavy-handed, writing about how the church in his hometown had made him pay many dues before her funeral, and how the caterers had stolen meat at the burial, wrapping chunks of beef in fresh banana leaves and throwing them across the compound wall to their accomplices, and how his relatives had become preoccupied with the stolen meat. Voices were raised, accusations flung back and forth, and an aunt had said,
"Those caterers must return every last bit of the stolen goods."
Stolen goods. His mother would have been amused about meat being a stolen good. And even by her funeral ending up as a brawl about stolen meat. Why, he wrote to Ifemelu, do our funerals become so quickly about other things that are not about the person who died? Why do the villagers wait for a death before they proceed to avenge past wrongs, those real and those imagined? And why do they dig deep to the bone in their bid to get their pound of flesh? Ifemelu's reply came an hour later, a rush of heartbroken words. I am crying as I write this. Do you know how often I wish that she was my mother? She was the only adult, except for Auntie Uju, who treated me like a person with an opinion that mattered. He was so fortunate to be raised by her. She was everything I wanted to be. I am so sorry, Siling. I can't imagine how ripped apart you must have felt. And still sometimes feel. I am in Massachusetts with Auntie Uju and Dike, and I am going through something right now that gives me a sense of that kind of pain, but only a small sense. Please give me a number so I can call.
if it's okay.
Her email made him happy. Seeing his mother through her eyes made him happy. And it emboldened him. He wondered what pain she was referring to, and hoped that it was the breakup with the black American, although he did not want the relationship to have mattered so much to her that the breakup would throw her into a kind of mourning. He tried to imagine how changed she would be now, how Americanized, especially after being in a relationship with an American. There was a manic optimism that he noticed in many of the people who had moved back from America in the past few years, a head-bobbing, ever-smiling, over-enthusiastic kind of manic optimism that bored him, because it was like a cartoon, without texture or depth. He hoped she had not become like that. He could not imagine that she would have. She had asked for his number. She could not feel so strongly about his mother if she did not still have feelings for him. So he wrote to her again, giving her all of his phone numbers, his 3 mobile phones, his office phone, and his home landline. He ended his email with these words.
It's strange how I have felt with every major event that has occurred in my life, that you were the only person who would understand.
He felt giddy, but after he clicked send, regrets assailed him. It had been too much too soon. He should not have written something so heavy. He checked his BlackBerry obsessively, day after day, and by the 10th day, he realized she would not write back. He composed a few emails apologizing to her, but he did not send them, because it felt awkward apologizing for something he could not name. He never consciously decided to write her the long, detailed emails that followed. His claim that he had missed her at every major event in his life was grandiose, he knew, but it was not entirely false. Of course, there were stretches of time when he had not actively thought about her, when he was submerged in his early excitement with Cosi, in his new child, in a new contract, but she had never been absent. He had held her always clasped in the palm of his mind, even through her silence and his confused bitterness. He began to write to her about his time in England, hoping she would reply, and then later looking forward to the writing itself. He had never told himself his own story, never allowed himself to reflect on it, because he was too disoriented by his deportation and then by the suddenness of his new life in Lagos. Writing to her also became a way of writing to himself. He had nothing to lose. Even if she was reading his emails with the black American and laughing at his stupidity, he did not mind. Finally, she replied. Ceiling. Sorry for the silence. Decay attempted suicide. I didn't want to tell you earlier, and I don't know why. He's doing much better. But it has been traumatic, and it's affected me more than I thought it would. You know, attempted doesn't mean it happened, but I've spent days crying, thinking about what might have happened. I'm sorry I didn't call to give you my condolences about your mother. I had planned to, and appreciated your giving me your phone number. But I took DK to his psychiatrist appointment that day, and afterwards I just couldn't get myself to do anything. I felt as if I had been felled by something. Auntie Uju tells me I have depression. You know America has a way of turning everything into an illness that needs medicine. I'm not taking medicines, just spending a lot of time with DK, watching a lot of terrible films with vampires and spaceships. I have loved your emails about England, and they have been so good for me, in so many ways, and I cannot thank you enough for writing them. I hope I will have a chance to fill you in on my own life, whenever that is. I've just finished a fellowship at Princeton, and for years I wrote an anonymous blog about race, which then became how I made my living, and you can read the archives here. I've postponed my return home. I'll be in touch. Take care, and I hope all is well with you and your family. Decay had tried to kill himself. It was impossible to comprehend. His memory of Decay was of a toddler, a white puff of Pampers at his waist, running around in the house in Dolphin Estate. Now he was a teenager who had tried to kill himself. Obinze's first thought was that he wanted to go to Ifemelu right away. He wanted to buy a ticket and get on a plane to America and be with her, console her, help Decay, make everything right. Then he laughed at his own absurdity.
Darling, you're not paying attention,
Kusi said to him.
Sorry, Omalicha, he said.
No work thoughts for now.
Okay, sorry. What were you saying?
They were in the car on their way to a nursery primary school in Ikoyi, visiting during the open day as guests of Jonathan and Isioma, Kosi's friend from church, whose son went there. Kosi had arranged it all, their second school visit, to help them decide where Buki would go. Ubinze had spent time with them only once, when Kosi invited them to dinner. He thought Isioma interesting. The few things she allowed herself to say were thoughtful, but she often remained silent, shrinking herself, pretending not to be as intelligent as she was, to salve Jonathan's ego, while Jonathan, a bank CEO whose photos were always in the newspapers, dominated the evening with long-winded stories about his dealing with estate agents in Switzerland, the Nigerian governors he had advised, and the various companies he had saved from collapse. He introduced Obinze and Kosi to the school headmistress, a small, round English woman, saying,
"Obinze and Kosi are our very close friends. I think their daughter might be joining us next year."
"Many high-level expatriates bring their children here," the headmistress said, her tone pride-tinged, and Obinze wondered if this was something she said routinely. She had probably said it often enough to know how well it worked, how much it impressed Nigerians. Isioma was asking why their son was not yet doing much of mathematics and English. "Our approach is more conceptual. We like the children to explore their environment during the first year," the headmistress said.
"But it should not be mutually exclusive. They can also start to learn some maths and English,"
Isioma said. Then, with an amusement that did not try to shield its underlying seriousness, she added,
"My niece goes to a school on the mainland, and at age 6 she could spell onomatopoeia."
The headmistress smiled tightly. She did not, her smile said, think it worthwhile to address the processes of lesser schools. Later, they sat in a large hall and watched the children's production of a Christmas play, about a Nigerian family who find an orphan on their doorstep on Christmas Day. Halfway through the play, a teacher turned on a fan that blew small bits of white cotton wool around the stage. Snow. It was snowing in the play.
"Why do they have snow falling? Are they teaching children that Christmas is not a real Christmas unless snow falls like it does abroad?"
Isioma said. Jonathan said,
"Uh-uh. What is wrong with that? It's just a play."
"It's just a play, but I also see what Isioma is saying," Kosi said, and then turned to Obinze. "Darling?"
Obinze said,
"The little girl that played the angel was very good."
"In the car," Kosi said,
"your mind is not here."
He read all the archives of Racetinth, or various observations about American blacks, those formerly known as Negroes, by a non-American black. The blog posts astonished him. They seemed so American and so alien, the irreverent voice with its slanginess, its mix of high and low language, and he could not imagine her writing them. He cringed reading her references to her boyfriends, the hot white ex, Professor Hunk. He read, just this evening, a few times, because it was the most personal post she had written about the black American, and he searched for clues and subtleties about what kind of man he was, what kind of relationship they had.
So, in NYC, Professor Hunk was stopped by the police. They thought he had drugs. American blacks and American whites use drugs at the same rate. Look this up. But say the word drugs and see what image comes to everyone's mind. Professor Hunk is upset. He says he's an Ivy League professor and he knows the deal. And he wonders what it would feel like if he were some poor kid from the inner city. I feel bad for my baby. When we first met, he told me how he wanted to get straight A's in high school because of a white teacher who told him to focus on getting a basketball scholarship. Black people are physically inclined, and white people are intellectually inclined. It's not good or bad, just different. And this teacher went to Columbia. Just saying. So he spent 4 years proving her wrong. I couldn't identify with this, wanting to do well to prove a point, but I felt bad then, too. So off to make him some tea, and administer some TLC. Because he had last known her, when she knew little of the things she blogged about, he felt a sense of loss, as though she had become a person he would no longer recognize.
Part 6 Chapter 43 For the first few days, Ifemelu slept on the floor in Dike's room. It did not happen. It did not happen. She told herself this often, and yet endless elliptical thoughts of what could have happened churned in her head. His bed, this room, would have been empty forever. Somewhere inside her, a gash would have ruptured that would never seal itself back. She imagined him taking the pills. Tylenol. Mere Tylenol. He had read on the internet that an overdose could kill you. What was he thinking? Did he think of her? After he came home from the hospital, his stomach pumped, his liver monitored, she searched his face, his gestures, his words, for a sign, for proof that it had really almost happened. He looked no different from before. There were no shadows under his eyes, no funereal air about him. She made him the kind of jollof rice he liked, flecked with bits of red and green peppers. And as he ate, fork moving from the plate to his mouth, saying, "This is pretty good," as he always had in the past, she felt her tears and her questions gathering. Why? Why had he done it? What was on his mind? She did not ask him because the therapist had said that it was best not to ask him anything yet. The days passed. She clung to him, wary of letting go and wary also of suffocating him. She was sleepless at first, refusing the small blue pill Auntie Uju offered her, and she would lie awake at night, thinking and turning, her mind held hostage by thoughts of what could have been, until she fell finally into a drained sleep. On some days, she woke up scarred with blame for Auntie Uju. "Do you remember when Dike was telling you something, and he said, 'We black folk,' and you told him, 'You are not black?'" she asked Auntie Uju, her voice low because Dike was still asleep upstairs. They were in the kitchen of the condo, in the soft flare of morning light, and Auntie Uju, dressed for work, was standing by the sink and eating yogurt, scooping from a plastic cup. "Yes, I remember." "You should not have done that." "You know what I meant. I didn't want him to start behaving like these people and thinking that everything that happens to him is because he's black."
"You told him what he wasn't, but you didn't tell him what he was."
"What are you saying?"
Auntie Uju pressed the lever with her foot. The trash can slid out, and she threw in the empty yogurt cup. She had switched to part-time work so that she could spend some time with Dike and drive him to his therapist appointments herself.
"You never reassured him."
"Ifemelu, his suicide attempt was from depression,"
Auntie Uju said gently, quietly.
"It is a clinical disease. Many teenagers suffer from it."
"Do people just wake up and become depressed?"
"Yes, they do."
"Not in Dike's case."
"Three of my patients have attempted suicide. All of them white teenagers. One succeeded,"
Auntie Uju said, her tone pacifying and sad, as it had been since Dike came home from the hospital.
"His depression is because of his experience, Auntie,"
Ifemelu said, her voice rising. And then she was sobbing, apologizing to Auntie Uju, her own guilt spreading and sullying her. Dike would not have swallowed those pills if she had been more diligent, more awake. She had crouched too easily behind laughter. She had failed to till the emotional soil of Dike's jokes. It was true that he laughed, and that his laughter convinced with its sound and its light, but it might have been a shield, and underneath there might have been a growing pea plant of trauma. Now, in the shrill, silent aftermath of his suicide attempt, she wondered how much they had masked with all that laughter. She should have worried more. She watched him carefully. She guarded him. She did not want his friends to visit, although the therapist said it was fine if he wanted them to. Even Paige, who had burst out crying a few days ago when she was alone with Ifemelu, saying,
"I just can't believe he didn't reach out to me."
She was a child, well-meaning and simple, and yet Ifemelu felt a wave of resentment towards her for thinking that Dike should have reached out to her. Kwaku came back from his medical mission in Nigeria, and he spent time with Dike, watching television with him, bringing calm and normalcy back. The weeks passed. Ifemelu stopped panicking when Dike stayed a little too long in the bathroom.
His birthday was days away, and she asked what he would like, her tears again gathering because she imagined his birthday passing not as the day he turned 17, but as the day he would have turned 17.
"How about we go to Miami?"
he said, half-joking. But she took him to Miami, and they spent 2 days in a hotel, ordering burgers at the thatch-covered bar by the pool, talking about everything but the suicide attempt.
"This is a life," he said,
lying with his face to the sun.
"That blog of yours was a great thing, had you swimming in the dough and all. Now you've closed it, you won't be able to do more of this stuff."
"I wasn't swimming, kind of just splattering," she said, looking at him, her handsome cousin, and the curl of wet hair on his chest made her sad, because it implied his new, tender adulthood, and she wished he would remain a child. If he remained a child, then he would not have taken pills and lain on the basement couch with the certainty that he would never wake up again.
"I love you, Diki. We love you, you know that."
"I know," he said.
"'Cause you should go."
"Go where?"
"Back to Nigeria, like you were planning to. I'm going to be okay. I promise."
"Maybe you could come and visit me?" she said.
After a pause, he said,
"Yeah."
Part 7 Chapter 44 At first, Lagos assaulted her. The sun-dazed haste, the yellow buses full of squashed limbs, the sweating hawkers racing after cars, the advertisements on hulking billboards, others scrawled on walls. "Plumber! Call 0801-777-77. And the heaps of rubbish that rose on the roadsides like a taunt. Commerce thrummed too defiantly, and the air was dense with exaggeration, conversations full of over-protestations. One morning, a man's body lay on Awolowo Road. Another morning, the island flooded and cars became gasping boats. Here she felt anything could happen. A ripe tomato could burst out of solid stone. And so she had the dizzying sensation of falling, falling into the new person she had become, falling into the strange familiar. Had it always been like this, or had it changed so much in her absence? When she left home, only the wealthy had mobile phones. All the numbers started with 090, and girls wanted to date 090 men. Now her hair braider had a mobile phone, the plantain seller tending a blackened grill had a mobile phone. She had grown up knowing all the bus stops and the side streets, understanding the cryptic codes of conductors and the body language of street hawkers. Now, she struggled to grasp the unspoken. When had shopkeepers become so rude? Had buildings in Lagos always had this pattern of decay? And when did it become a city of people quick to beg and too enamored of free things?
"Americana," Ranyanudo teased her often. "You are looking at things with American eyes, but the problem is that you are not even a real Americana. At least if you had an American accent, we would tolerate your complaining."
Ranyanudo picked her up from the airport, standing by the arrival's exit in a billowy bridesmaid's dress, her blusher too red on her cheeks like bruises, the green satin flowers in her hair now askew. Ifemelu was struck by how arresting, how attractive she was. No longer a ropey mass of gangly arms and gangly legs, but now a big, firm, curvy woman, exulting in her weight and height. And it made her imposing, a presence that drew the eyes.
"Rangi,"
Ifemelu said.
"I know my coming back is a big deal, but I didn't know it was big enough for a ball gown. Idiot, I came straight from the wedding. I didn't want to risk the traffic of going home first to change."
They hugged, holding each other close. Ranyanudo smelled of a floral perfume and exhaust fumes and sweat. She smelled of Nigeria.
"You look amazing, Rangi," Ifemelu said.
"I mean, underneath all that war paint. Your pictures don't even show you well." "Ifemsko, see you, beautiful babe, even after a long flight," she said laughing,
dismissing the compliment, playing at her old role of the girl who was not the pretty one. Her looks had changed, but the excitable, slightly reckless air about her had not. Unchanged, too, was the eternal gurgle in her voice, laughter just beneath the surface, ready to break free, to erupt. She drove fast, braking sharply,
and glancing often at the BlackBerry on her lap. Whenever the traffic stilled, she picked it up and typed.